Monday night, and that means from high above, beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. This is John McMullen. Welcome to the 128th episode of the weekly John Mack Radio Show. The URL for the previous 127 shows and the names of the next month or so's episodes may be found at www.johnmack13.com on the radio show tab. And John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-A-C. That's John Mack 13. com. My most recent piece for the Westchester Guardian is that website, www.westchesterguardian.com, and Westchester Guardian is W-E-S-T-C-H-D-S-T-E-R.com. It's the 197th column in the Creative Disruption series. We're moving into March, the month of madness, spring break, and Easter, and the shows in March will have the very interesting, hopefully, the roster of guests. Science fiction writer David Gerard, radio show host from Boston, Jordan Rich, and next week's guest, author, editor, and dancer, Sari Wilson. So now to this show. Callers may call at any time during the show by dialing 646-716-9756. That's 646-716-9756. My guest is physicist, game developer, and corporate executive William Volk. I first met William on Facebook and was fascinated by how his education morphed into game development and corporate management. Good evening, William, and welcome to the show.
Good evening. Thank you for having me on.
Now, let's start at the beginning. Where did you grow up and then go to early school?
I actually grew up in New York, in a town called Oceanside, not too far from New York City. Did my elementary and high school in Oceanside. What's interesting is even though I grew up in Oceanside, not far from New York City, I lived on the edge of what's called the Marine Nature Preserve, which is still there. So I actually lived in a marshland, basically, next to a marsh, which is funny. So we'd actually see the World Trade Centers going up, and yet we'd be out there fishing and running around in the marsh and catching things and so on. It was a very interesting childhood.
Now, does Oceanside in Queens or
Nassau County, called, South Shore?
Called Long Island, Nassau County. Okay.
Yeah. South Shore, Nassau County, Great South Bay.
Then where'd you go to high school?
Oceanside High School. Go Sailors.
Okay. And how old were you when you first got into video and computer games?
Well, I started seeing video games when I was in high school. And you know, what's interesting is I remember being quite young and watching the movie 2001 when it came out. And I had a misunderstanding. I remember the scenes from 2001 when they were docking the so-called Pan Am spaceship with the space station, those graphics. I thought that was really graphics. I kind of knew something about computers, and I looked at those scenes and said, I want to have something like that. I want to be able to play something like that, even though that movie, which was made in the late 60s, I believe, didn't actually use computer graphics. All those things were drawn animations, but I believe they were computer graphics, and it actually got me thinking about games because at the time, the only thing we had in the arcades was very, very simple games like Lunar Lander and Pong and so on. But I saw the scenes from, I can remember distinctly looking at the scenes from 2001, A Space Odyssey, and saying, that would be really great. That would be an awesome thing to be able to do with games and stuff. Of course, Star Wars, same thing. The Star Wars movie, the first one, really got me thinking about where games could go.
My son Luke, who's a video writer and producer, played Pong on an RCA game console on our television set.
Yeah.
That was the earliest thing that I remember, even before the Atari. They had the Pong too, but it was called Breakout, I think.
It was the Cosmic Dip. I remember that machine. Yes, the RCA video game machine.
And at that time, did you actually think that you would have the career in the business, or did you want to, or did you?
It was so weird and random how the whole thing unfolded. Literally, I was in my first year of graduate school, and I was looking for a job during Christmas break. This is December of 1979, and I saw a job being advertised by a company in Baltimore. I was in grad school for a year at Maryland, and they wanted play testers. And I said to myself, well, that looks like an interesting thing to do during the break. I'll do that. And what they were doing was they were doing strategic games for the Radio Shack TRS-80 and the Apple II and the Commodore PET, machines like that. They needed them play tested. And so I started as a play tester at a company called the Avalon Hill Game Company, which was known for board games. But they were getting into computer games, and that's what I was actually doing as a part-time person in December of 79. And that's how it all started.
What did you do after high school, between then and grad school?
Oh, well, I went to university. I was lucky. I actually had a very interesting college career. I went to University of Pennsylvania, Penn, go Quakers. I got into Penn, and I originally came in as an English major, but I switched to physics and actually did quite well in physics and astronomy at University of Pennsylvania. I actually got to work in the summer of 1978 on something called the neutrino telescope at the Homestake Gold Mine in Deadwood, South Dakota. There was a gold mine, and there was this neutrino experiment that was occurring a mile underneath the ground, and I was the only undergraduate to sort of work on this that summer. For a reason, I guess it wasn't too clear to me until I got there. Basically, at the time, I was really into cycling. I was on the Penn Cycling Club team, and I was one of the few students in the physics department who could really move stuff around that tunnel, the tunnels of the actual gold mine. So they brought me in to help out with the project, and I spent the entire summer a mile underneath the ground. Yeah, which is crazy.
And did you stay with physics into grad school?
Yeah, I continue in physics. I actually started taking computer classes at Penn. Here's another bizarre story. In 78, the Moore College of Electrical Engineering had a class in microcomputers, and a friend of mine was taking it, but there weren't enough students for the class, so he asked me to join the class, and that's when I started playing with graphics. So I actually started programming and doing computer graphics at Penn, and that's why when the job showed up at Maryland for playtesting games, I jumped at it because I was already familiar with what these computers could do in terms of graphics and so on.
And you went to the University of Maryland
for one year. Yeah, at College Park, and then in a graduate program in physics. And then I switched to University of New Hampshire because University of New Hampshire would let me continue with my physics degree but also take computer engineering and computer science classes. They were open to that, so I switched to University of New Hampshire. By the time I left Maryland, I had my first game built that was actually published by Avalon Hill, that being Conflict 2500. That came out in 1981. And so when I was at University of New Hampshire, I actually was continuing to write games for Avalon Hill. What basically happened was I had one of my critique of the early Avalon Hill games was that the machines should be able to do some graphics and we should be doing more graphics in our games. So I wrote this strategic game called Conflict 2500 when I was the summer between Maryland and New Hampshire. And then I basically continued in New Hampshire to write two more Avalon Hill games. One was called Voyager 1, which was extraordinarily ambitious first-person wireframe shooting game. And then the other one, which was extraordinarily fortuitous, was Controller, the air traffic control game, which actually hit the market just about the time we had the air traffic control incident with Ronald Reagan as president. So it actually did very well. And it still looks pretty cool considering how long ago it was created. It had a realistic-looking radar display. You were guiding aircraft to safe landings. So it was a lot of fun. I did that in conjunction. Yeah,
go ahead.
Well, I did that because someone at a computer store in New Hampshire, a guy who had been an air boss in the Navy, basically a Navy air traffic controller, asked me to start working on this with him. And that guy was Frank D. Kelly, and he basically had been in the Navy, and he was the one who motivated me to do it. And just as we were doing it, the whole air traffic control thing unfolded, so it made a lot of sense. Yeah.
Now, what language did you write it in, and what platform did it come out of for?
Well, Control was written basically in BASIC and assembly language. Most of the games were. Controller, I believe, ran on the Apple II, the Atari 800, 400. I believe there might have been an IBM PC version, and I think there was also a TRS-80 version. But the game Voyager, I think, was the one that ran on almost every platform there was. It ran on Commodore PET, TRS-80 Coco, TRS-80 Model 1, Model 3, Atari 800, 400, Apple II, IBM PC, everything that was. In fact, what's funny is that a couple of years ago, I found out that it had been ported after I had, with not knowing that I had done it, someone else did it, ported to like some of the Japanese machines. So Voyager 1 actually was ported to some of the machines in Japan, like the Sharp and so on, and the NEC. So it was actually...
Now, coincidentally, at that time, my firm did a bunch of testing and porting to different machines because, if you remember, all of the basics were a little different. It was Apple.
Oh yeah.
Apple for the PC. So we had six computers, and we had kids who did this as well as some adult supervision, and they had to set it up so they used the same line numbers, but we have to branch to a high line number to get into the right code on that machine where there were differences, and also to exit to assembler, which was totally different, and to come back. So did you actually do the assembly work and the basic for all the platforms?
Yeah, for example, Voyager 1, I basically had assembly language routines to draw vectors on the TRS-80. On the Commodore PET, there was a famous Commodore guy out of Canada who had just knew that machine, and he created for me a vector assembly language routine for the Commodore PET. So even though this thing was a wireframe 3D maze crawler, basically, he had it. And so I think some of the versions, like I think the Coco was fast enough where it didn't really need anything. It just sort of worked perfectly well. The Atari 800 was pretty close to as good as that. But the TRS-80 Model 1 version, which for some reason the graphics they used on the box, I don't know why, and the Apple II version needed some help. And we actually did a version for the original IBM PC in DOS. And then, in terms of... Let me see if I can find the Sharp one. I don't know. Yeah, there it is. So Avalon Hill, basically ported the game over to other machines. Even after, I wasn't even aware there was a version for the Japanese market until a couple of years ago. It's kind of crazy. There it was.
Yeah, I have a few more general questions about game development before getting into your actual career. Have you always done games at the machine, the local machine level, or have you also gotten into the online game business?
Well, I'm trying to think the best way to say it. I got into online gaming pretty late, and mostly in a different role because I was working with programmers in the mobile space. My career in gaming ended up being mainly the adventure game world. Up until the early 90s. And then when mobile hit in early 2000, I jumped into trying to do online games in a big way. So that was really where I hit online gaming. I played online games and I believed in it. There were so many indications that online gaming was going to be large. I will tell you one story, though. At Avalon Hill, I guess in 1980-81, I suggested that we build an online version of one of their board games, in this case, Squad Leader or Western Front, either one. And the idea I wanted to do is I wanted to have a mainframe running the game with the computer versions, the microcomputers being basically very sophisticated graphics terminals, and they wanted this ongoing war to be going on. You'd drop in and you'd be put into a, you know, conflict situations with other players in a sort of real-time map of the entire Western front of the World War II at a certain time and date and time. And that was so overly ambitious, no one wanted to touch it. But we actually did talk about it for a while. This is literally 1981, 82, you know?
Now, what about the app game, such as a solitaire one? Do I play it on my tablets and phones now? Have you gotten into any of them?
I have a very long career in mobile games. It starts in
apps.
2000
okay.
and it goes on. And okay. I actually co-designed the first, this is, sounds crazy, but I co-designed the first iPhone game. What happened there is I was at a company at the time which was known as MyNumo that became PlayScreen, and we had done a flash-based game based on freeing Paris Hilton from jail, and we were looking for something new to do, and we saw this video of Steve Ballmer of Microsoft laughing about the new iPhone, that it was going to be the most expensive phone in the world, and it was too expensive and wasn't going to succeed. We, of course, disagreed. And so back then, all you had was web-based programming for the iPhone. So we built a game called iWack, which is still out there. I think there are links to it still out there. iWack was basically a whack-a-mole with Ballmer popping out of holes, and you just simply tap to get points, tap on his head as he popped out. This thing was literally created the weekend the iPhone shipped. We didn't even have an iPhone. We were relying on people we knew who had managed to get one to tell us what we needed to change. I can remember desperately, this is like 2007, desperately trying to find ways of doing audio on the device. And it was really, really hard to get audio to work. It just simply wasn't happening. So it was a silent game, which was annoying to me. And so for 2007 and a good part of 2008, we produced over 20 web-based games. And at that time, I was more of a business executive, but co-designer on a lot of these titles. We did a game that was sort of a takeoff on Frogger called Carmadillo. We did all the card games. I actually got us for a while. We had the license to Kenny Rogers. So we had Kenny Rogers Blackjack, Kenny Rogers Slots, Kenny Rogers Video Poker, originally all as HTML-based games. We actually did very well with that, and we were probably one of the few companies that was kind of like, oh, they do apps now, that's going to be a lot more difficult because it's going to be a lot more competition. We were kind of out there with some of the companies doing all this web-based ad-supported stuff on the iPhone when the actual app market finally launched in 2008.
As in the side, you're getting kind of the raspy. I don't know if the phone had moved away or.
Yeah, well, it's probably me. Yeah. Recovering from a cold.
Now let's come back to your career. So you're during grad school in physics and computer engineering, and you're doing games, and where did your career start off? Did you go into physics or did you go directly into gaming?
Well, here's what happened. Another name, interesting. I was learning a programming language called Forth, and I'd written for the Atari Program Exchange. Remember the Atari Program Exchange, APEX?
Reverse Polish notation.
Yeah, well, Atari had their own app store. People don't remember this, but Atari had a mail order thing called the Atari Program Exchange, APX, where independent software producers could build games for the Atari 800, and Atari would actually have a catalog of these games. And I did several products for them. I did a terminal program called SST, or Super Smart Terminal. But what I also did was, I at grad school in computer engineering, I was sort of introduced to a lot of people at the MIT AI lab, and I got to meet Seymour Papert and Marvin Minsky and saw what they were doing with Logo. And I thought Logo was a fascinating language. And there was no logo for the Atari 800, so I wrote something in Forth called Forth Turtle Graphics Plus, which was an extension to the Forth that Atari was selling that gave it turtle graphics function. So you could tell the turtle to move forward, you could tell it to drop the pen, raise the pen, and you could do recursive things and draw cute patterns and so on in Forth as opposed to Logo, but the syntax was similar. In Logo, you might say go five, and Forth you'd say five go. Okay, same thing. You basically are telling a turtle to move forward 5 pixels. So I was marketing this, and at the same time, I was working on a wireframe 3D thing, which became known as called Val Graphics and Val World. So there was a company called Valpar International out of Arizona that was doing a 4 for the Atari, and they were selling packages, and I had sold them the 2D package and a 3D package. By the time this was going on, I had taken computer graphics in graduate school. I knew something about windowing systems. So this system allowed you to set windows for output on the screen of the Atari. It sounds ambitious, and it was, but you could draw things and do 3D wireframe objects and so on. I heard of a computer coming out in 82 called the Epson QX10. And I got in contact with Epson at a trade show in Boston and said, I'd like to sell you this software for the Epson QX10. It sounds like a very nice machine. This was a machine that was based on the Z80, but it had a graphics coprocessor called the NEC7220. It had 640 by 400 black and white graphics that were very crisp. It had a dedicated monitor, so it looked pretty decent. And they said, you need to talk to our company in California called Rising Star. And so I got on the phone with Rising Star. This is number November of 1982. And they said to me, you know, we'd like you to come out here and run programming on the West Coast. Now, the reason for that is because I had a fancy college degree, you know, and I was in graduate school. I've been at Avalon Hill. I had good references from the people in the computer science world, and they wanted me to come in there and become like a major programmer slash manager for them. And I said something to the effect was, well, I'm not leaving grad school unless I get paid such and such money, such as this money being outrageous. And they said, sure, we'll pay you that much. And I left grad school. I did earn my master's according to the University of Hampshire, but I left grad school and went to work for Rising Star eventually in California. That's how I ended up in California. They moved me to California in 1983.
It's funny. The Forth and APO are the only two programming languages that became like religious to people. You talk
oh,
to
my
people
God. So true.
About and they go, oh, you got to see this. You got to see this. And if you're looking at them, and they'd be showing you stacks coming off. Don't be showing you the programs doing anything. They'd just be showing you how the stack was replenished. Or the APL people. I remember running the conference at the United Nations on it was on technology. It was United Nations School, the Apple User Group, and the IBM User Group, and the APL guy, his big thing was he had all sorts of program listings, and this program then COBOL would take was 27 pages, and in BASIC it was 15 pages, and in APL it was one page, you know, and it didn't matter how complex the program was, it only took one page, you know.
Well, they were teaching APL at the Wharton School at Penn back in the 70s.
Right.
It was actually a language that they were teaching people. And Forth, you know, it was interesting because where I really used Forth was when the Macintosh came out. We'll talk about that in a bit. But I never actually shipped a Forth game on the Atari, though. I had all this amazing stuff. I was just looking for something that was sort of like give me access to assembly language fast and have a really compact interpreter. Forth was kind of language where if you knew what you were doing, and that was a big if, you could write stuff that was smaller than assembly language because it would pack every instruction into a 16-bit word. And, you know, we did some crazy things, you know. And Rising Star was using Forth and assembly language on the Z80. I was brought in initially to work on the word processor, and then eventually I wrote a drawing program called ValDraw, which was this. I have the source code lying around because every now and then I get the urge to look at it to try to figure out how I did it. I had a 50K address space, and I wrote a CAD-CAM program that drove pretty much any plotter you wanted to drive, and on the screen displayed dimensions with fractional numbers, had rotating text fonts, and you know, arrays and all this 2D CAD-CAM stuff. It was amazing, and it ran in 50 kilobytes. It was virtual memory and the whole bit. It was such an overly crazy program. And it made Rising Star some good money. I ended up being the West Coast technical manager. But Rising Star itself was an interesting tale of woe. And by 84, even though I was a Rising Star, I had fallen in love with the Macintosh. Totally believed the Macintosh was the be-all and end-all, and all I wanted to do was code on the Macintosh.
Well, Epson for a while had the PC compatible. Did Rising Star move to that and then to the Macintosh?
No, not really.
Epson.
They just stayed on the Z80. They were on the Z80 based QX10, and that's what they were. The QX16 came out. It was sort of PC compatible, and Rising Star faded after a while. I left there at the very beginning of 85. I left Rising Star, and it was an interesting company because it was so ambitious. The stuff that Rising Star did was so far ahead of its time in terms of a productivity platform. The word processor, which I worked on, had undos, and it had, you know, fancy ruler lines, and one thing you could do in the word processor, which is amazing, I don't see it very often today, is if you put down a column of numbers, you could then put an equation that would total the numbers in that column, even though it was a word processor. It did spreadsheet-like things in the word processor. It had a really interesting file name system where a file could be like letter to John about the need to ship widgets to Japan by Friday. That would be a legitimate file name, and you could search for file names like give me all the letters to this person, and so on. It was a very sophisticated filing system for the Z80-based computer. They also, Avalon Hill, had most of its people working from home and had a system with modems, 1,200 baud and then 2,400 baud modems, enabling you to sort of do your work collaboratively with other people. And this is, remember, the early 80s. This was so far ahead of the game. But I really wanted to jump on the Mac in such a big way. And I basically decided to write a game for the Mac, sort of similar to Voyager 1, but using solid, in this case, four direction perspective graphics, solid graphics, and that was done in Forth, and that became the Pyramid of Peril. When you see the video of the first Macworld show that they show, that's out there on the internet, when they show the first Macworld show, which was January of 1985, you'll see the game actually booting up on one of the Macs. That game was actually pretty good, and that game was conceived, written, programmed, had some help on the art, and heat shrinked in boxes in a space of 30 days. From concept to at Macworld, in boxes, selling the game, 30 days. The craziest, we just didn't sleep.
Now, who were you with at that time?
We started a company called Aegis Development. Myself,
okay.
Dave Barrett, Michelle Materian, and eventually John Skeel. A lot of these people have gone on to some amazing things. And Aegis was an amazing ride. We started out as the Mac game company. I did a Pyramid Apparel, and then I did a flight simulator, which was unfortunately named Mac Challenger, the Space Shuttle Flight Simulator. So I did a wireframe flight simulator for the Mac. Both Voyager and Pyramid Apparel had the interesting feature of being algorithmically generated games. The levels in those games, the Voyager game in 1982 on all those early PCs and the Pyramid Apparel game in 1984, used algorithmically generated levels. So the levels themselves were generated algorithmically. The terrain was algorithmically generated, so to speak. And they had the interesting feature of having maps that showed you what you had seen, but not necessarily everything in the world. The map would only show you what you'd actually observed. What was going on was the display routines that were doing the actual display stuff were actually sending bits on the map to tell the map what to reveal. So those were advanced. When we did Mac Challenger, the thing that we came up with, which has become very common, is that we actually had multiple cameras. So after you flew the shuttle, successfully or not, to a landing, you could watch the playback with VCR-like control from multiple cameras, including including cameras that were actually chase plane cameras. So it was really out there type game for the Mac, and it was a big success. And then, of course, we had the shuttle Challenger disaster, and the game was pulled off the market.
Was Aegis directly after Rising Star?
Yeah, directly after Rising Star. So I went from grad school.
how did you put together this company then to go off on your own? How'd you do that?
Well, we had a guy named David Barrett, who was the CEO. We had Michelle Matarian, who's now Michelle Matarian Bowman, who was the marketing person, and myself. And then we're a couple of people joined in, a guy named John Skeel, who became like the marketing guy. And what we did is we actually raised money. We actually did get money from investors to build this company. And we became known as the Amiga software company. We became known as a company that did a lot of stuff for the Amiga. And I have to tell you, that itself is hilarious because I'm at a Mac event looking at the premiere of VideoWorks, which became Macromedia Director. And a guy named Mark Cantor, who's famous, you know, he founded Macromedia, pulls me aside and says, forget the Mac, Bill. The Amiga is going to be the future. Now, what's funny about that is Mark never did anything for the Amiga, decided not to do anything for the Amiga. But he got me convinced that I needed to look at this Amiga computer that was coming out. And we did look at the Atari ST as well, but Tramiel, who had taken over Atari, wanted $5,000 in 1985 for a development system. Commodore, just on the basis of what we had already done, shipped us a bunch of Amigas for free and wanted us to do software for the Amiga. And so I took what I had done at Rising Star, the experience I had in CAD-CAM with that Galdraw product, into something called AgeStraw and AgeStraw Professional, AgeStraw 2000 on the Amiga. I did this fancy drawing program on the Amiga. And yes, we were working on some game stuff as well, although that didn't really happen. But it did lead to some very big things that happened in the future. So we jumped, we got funded, and what was going on, the reason Aegis took off so well is there was a company called Island Graphics. Island Graphics was a major graphics software company based in Sausalito, California, and they had been contracted by Commodore to create the initial drawing programs for the Commodore Amiga. In fact, when you look at the rollout of the Amiga at Lincoln Center and you see, like, Andy Warhol drawing on the Amiga, some of that software is Island Graphics stuff. Island Graphics and Commodore got into a major fight. We went up to Island Graphics and we negotiated a deal where we took over all their software for the Amiga, made Commodore happy, made Island Graphics happy, and we ended up going out the door with a paint program and a business graphics program and a very interesting animation program called Aegis Animator that ended up being used by a lot of music video people. I wrote AegisStraw, and there you go. We built the company from I think like a $50,000 investment to several million dollars a year. And this is a cautionary note. When you're in your 20s and all of this is happening, you're probably convinced that this will always be the case. You'll always be able to do something like that. And the truth is, and it wasn't me who said this, it was John Skeel. He said, you know, we were young and we just didn't realize what we had in our hands. And we allowed some setbacks and some personality things to sort of hurt the company. And in hindsight, that was one of the dumber things I did. I think that if I were to give my list of Williams' worst decisions, one was stopping being an independent game developer when I was at Avalon Hill. I could have done that forever. Every game I wrote was getting published. I was stupid not to continue doing it. The second thing was probably not doing anything I could to keep Aegis going. But I did get hired out of Aegis to work for Activision. And I was at Activision for 6 years.
Many people did the wrong thing. For instance, when the obvious ones were when Lotus and WordPerfect chose not to have the Windows version of their software, even though they developed something for OS 2. You know, it's just take you back to the Mega and to Commodore. Jack Tramiel was a very tough businessman, and he also had a tremendous reputation for not paying his bills. He expected other people to pay him, but not paying his bills. Did you ever do Macworld Boston?
Yeah, we did Macworld San Francisco in the beginning of 85, and then we did Macworld Boston. Funny story, everything we shipped to Macworld Boston was spray-painted Yo-Yo Dine Corporation. We took everything, created up, and put Yo-Yo Dine Corporation because this movie had just come out called Buckaroo Banzai, and we thought that was hysterical.
Okay.
And also at Macworld, I can tell you the other story is my ex-wife, Mary will remember Macworld Boston forever, because when we sat down on the cruise, we were sitting next to a guy who I had known from the Apple II days named John Draper. And John was a character, and I think Mary was
Captain Crunch. Captain Crunch.
Who is this guy? He had, well, I'm not going to get into details, but he was kind of hard to sit next to, and she was just freaked out by him. It was like one of the funniest things. So we did Macworld Boston as well, and it was a great show. Aegis was a very interesting company. What?
Did you smoke then?
I never smoked in my life. My dad was a hellacious smoker.
What Draper used to do was, Draper hated smoking, and if he was smoking, he would pull the cigarette right out of your hand.
This is true.
Yeah, I know, John.
He was not into so much into smelling sweet himself, so he was always interesting to sit next to. He was a tough guy.
Then he used to wear a cape. And I remember he promulgated the story that he was the hacker that Sneakers was based on, and he got fired from this outfit that he was doing Macintosh development for, and I was writing at the time, and I listened to his story, and I called the company, and of course they swore that they had lost some contracts and they had to lay people off. But
Draper had done stuff on the Apple II, a word processing program, in Forf. So I knew him from the early 80s because of the Forf community.
Right.
One of the things I was known for in Forf is I had decided that Forf was too hard to read. So I had come up with this technique, this layer above Forf that made it look almost C-like, and made it easy to do things like, you know, instead of saying, you know, dupe, swap, plus whatever, you could say the arguments to this thing are X, Y, and Z, X, Z, plus, store into C, Z. You know, you could write something that was more legit. And so Draper was interested in that, and I had presented this stuff at Asilomar in 1984, I guess, in this conference in Asilomar. And, I'm still friends with a lot of people who worked on that. It's amazing that we stay in touch, but it was an interesting era. So, yeah, we went to Pyramid Apparel and Mac Challenger. We showed at Boston conference. Those were written in Forf. We also did some other productivity packages for the Mac. We did something called the Housekeeper, which was an insurance, a product that basically allowed you to basically keep track of what you needed for insurance purposes. And we did a product that basically scored your writing called Word Tools. We did it with a famous person. Let me see if I can find that. What that is, Aegis. It is Word Tools. What a memory, because I don't even remember this one, but I do remember this was a big deal because we had a this product along with a famous pundit in the Mac world, and it was it was a pretty cool little product. Yeah. Pretty nice.
Well, two funny stories that come to mind. Draper, the program that Draper wrote, the word processor for the Apple II Easy Writer, was the biggest seller
on there.
He also did the fourth compiler for the Apple. But IBM, if you remember, they purchased the rights to all of the number one programs, or they cut deals with the company that had purchased the rights to VisiCalc and to all these different things, and to EasyWriter, because even though it was by that time not the best word processor, it was the name. Now, EasyWriter on the PC was terrible.
EasyWriter, right.
The company, RUS, that brought it out, they blamed Draper, and Draper blamed the company, and from then on his stock went down. Now, on Macworld, we gave the talk at the show that HyperCard had been announced the year before, and I was the moderator from one of the panels, and because I wrote a column for New York Magazine about it, and Bonnie McBird, who had written the screenplay for Tron, and then also did all of the videos then for company for John Scully. She was on a panel, and someone from Dartmouth, where they were using HyperCard and all sorts of things. And they moved us to the Wang Center, where the to this auditorium, the Wang Auditorium, that held like 600 people. And the place was packed. And I said, gee, there's an awful lot of people here for our talk. I wonder why. Is HyperCard that popular? Are we that popular? At the end of our talk, and as people are filing out, Bonnie's husband came through the curtain, Alan Kay, and Bill Gates, who was there on the panel before us. So obviously they were the draw, and we were just the overflow after it.
I had one conversation with Mr. Gates, and that was in 1990 at a party run by Tandy for their CD-ROM stuff when I was at Activision. And Bill and I talked for about 15, 20 minutes about how Mode 13 Hex on the PC was the premier game mode for PCs and was a huge advantage over what the Mac had because it had so many fewer pixels but rich color. It was perfect for arcade and adventure games of the era. All the Sierra stuff was done in it, all the LucasArts stuff was done in it, and we had this conversation, and he was very smart, very nice, and knew the intersection of technology and business quite well. He was quite impressive, and this was literally in 1990.
Yeah, I met him in the 80s at some conferences that a fellow who I was with at Morgan Stanley, Ben Rosen, had, at Lake Geneva, Wisconsin, and the venture capitalists were all over him. And at that time, he was extremely quiet. He just said yes, yes, and he didn't do anything with them. He held on to the business for himself for a long time, you know. So he was, but it was interesting then.
He just got me involved with Compact Disc Interactive because we were doing stuff. That was the game we were going to do with Philips Corporation, with their American Interactive Media. And that's where I realized, many people don't realize this, but that's when I realized Microsoft had, it was probably Ballmer who I was seeing in action. Microsoft was extremely good at manipulating release information and so on to basically kill competition. They did a fantastic job. Microsoft really probably is why Compact Disc Interactive didn't happen the way it was supposed to happen, because what Microsoft did is they got RCA to announce something called Digital Video Interactive, which never really shipped, but the announcement of DVI effectively delayed CDI, and delaying CDI is what really killed it, because when I got to Activision in 88, everyone was gung-ho for Compact Disc Interactive. Electronic Arts had a guy named Luc Bartolet who had built this incredible development system that was just unbelievably cool for building CDI titles, because it was the first time we were doing optical disc. And Activision had a big investment in it, but by 88, I realized CDI wasn't going to happen. So when I got to Activision, one of the smartest things I ever did was to green light a title, the HyperCard title, on CD called The Manhole, and that was originally been created by Rand and Robin Miller of Cyan. So yeah, one of the smart things I did was basically got Activision to publish Rand and Robin Miller's Cyan's first game. And a lot of things that happened at Activision for me happened because of that. It led to everything. It even leads to Return to Zork. So, yes. So, Microsoft was super smart.
I go back to the mainframe days, and Microsoft learned that from IBM. IBM used to have something that marketing was FUD. Fear,
uncertainty, and dismay.
And doubt, right. And I remember Burroughs had a terrific machine about the time of the 360 was out, to the 5500, and I was an officer of some Wall Street firms and would be talking to them, and then they dropped to IBM and it'd say, well, but we can't say anymore.
No one ever got fired for buying IBM. Remember that?
Right,
the saying that went around back then? You could never get fired for buying IBM.
We can't say anything about what's coming out next year. Say, what do you have coming out next year? You know, and they did that all the time. They were very successful.
Yeah, well, Microsoft picked up on that big time. Yeah.
Yeah, how long was Activision in?
I was Activision from 88 to 94. I am, believe it or not, one of the few senior people who was retained by Bobby Kotick. And this, again, is an example of really good luck, because I knew Bobby from the Amiga days, because Bobby had his big Amiga company. And so Bobby and I knew each other from the Amiga days. So when Bobby took over Activision in 1991, he knew who I was, and he knew, and he decided to keep me on board. So I was the only senior guy who was kept on board for Activision. When Activision moved from Northern California to Los Angeles in 92, I think we were down at one point to about 13 people. We were really cut down. Activision had been hit with a patent judgment in 1990 regarding the Magnavox, the bar patent, and Activision basically started bleeding money and going out of business very, very fast. We actually did go through a Chapter 11 in 1992 with Bobby, and we came out of that in 93, partly because of Return to Zork, which itself is an amazing story. Lots of good coincidences there, because I don't think I would have been retained if I hadn't known Bobby beforehand. And I became the vice president of Activision, of technology for Activision. By 1993, I was the vice president of technology for Activision.
Yeah. Okay. And then you mentioned about Return to Zork. How did that turn the company around?
Well, here's what happened with Return to Zork. So we did the Manhole. As a hypercar title, was Cyan. And then we had to find a way of getting that title onto the PC and other machines. So we had been working on the development system that was sort of similar to what Infocom had done, but graphical. And I started working on that at Aegis Development. And that eventually became the Multimedia Applications Development Environment, which was this language interpreter that was sort of like a scheme, almost like a little Lisp, with all sorts of graphics routines, and that was used to put Manhole on DOS and on machines like the FM Towns in Japan and the NEC 9801 in Japan. I literally walked in with the Activision's guy in Japan, and we sold Fujitsu on putting Manhole on FM Towns. So we were starting to build games of this, and when Activision got into big trouble, we were working with Steve Moretzky, who had done the original Lever Goddesses on something called Lever Goddesses of Phobos 2, which got panned by the critics. Mind you, we were pretty much out of business. It felt that way, and we only had a few people to work on it. All the art for Lever Goddesses 2 was drawn on paper and scanned in. That's how the game was done. It was very comic book looking. And it was too easy. It was too quick. So it's 1992, 93, and we're working on Return to Zork. We're all annoyed about Lever Goddesses 2. We're all mad at the reviewers for panning it. We felt it was a fun game. So we decided to make Return to Zork the most unfair, crazy adventure game ever produced. There are over 4,000 YouTube videos devoted to this game, most of which are complaining about how unfair the game is. But Return to Zork was extraordinarily innovative. It had things in the game that really don't exist even today in many games. For example, every time an NPC talked to you, it would be recorded, and you could ask any NPC about what any other NPC had to say. So any character you encounter in the game said something to you, you could ask someone else about that. You could take pictures of everything and show people the pictures, and they would comment on it. It was that sophisticated. Eddie Dumbrower was the producer. He had seen some stuff at MIT regarding interfaces, and we had come up with this diamond reverse parser interface. Objects could be used with other objects. It had deep and ridiculously unfair puzzles, but that was all possible because of the UI. So Return to Zork did about $40 million in retail or so. It did very well. And that and a product called the Pitfall Harry, the Return to Pitfall product, really got Activision off the ground. Activision was able to raise money, and then, of course, Activision finally shipped 4 years later than it was supposed to. Late 1994, Activision finally shipped MechWarrior 2, which was a huge success. So I did the game engine for Return to Zork. I was not the producer. I was the technical producer. So I wrote the game engine. I did the graphics and the video codecs. I did the UI, the user interface, which was very weird and interesting. And so I wrote the video drivers and all that. And we had some good people writing. We had some famous actors, but B-speed level actors shot on video. It was all digital video. And the product did very well. It was actually a really breakthrough product. But it was one of the reasons I kind of left Activision was that Activision, in a most ironic twist of events, Activision had lost Cyan as a developer in 1990 when Activision started getting into financial trouble. They had gone to Broderbund. They had done NIST. NIST was just such a huge success. Activision was convinced that they had to basically go down that route with a game that wasn't so deep in terms of the puzzle interaction. So it's ironic because I'm the man who basically got Activision to publish Cyan's first game. So a little bit of irony there. I was heavily recruited out of Activision to go to an educational software company startup called Lightspan to basically run development for Lightspan. I wanted to do another game like Return to Zork, but some of Activision's management wasn't interested in doing that. So we were a little bit in conflict there. In hindsight, leaving Activision when I was vice president of Activision was probably not necessarily the wisest move in my entire career, but I went to Lightspan and I wanted to do stuff for kids because I had young children at the time. And Lightspan was an amazing company with amazing stuff happening. And to sum it up, since you were in the stock market, we went public in February of 2000 with Credit Suisse, and our market capitalization when we went public was $1 billion.
Wow. Wow.
And then the markets collapsed.
Right, right. Everything went down the tubes then, yeah. Okay, how long were you there?
I was at Lightspan from 94 to the very beginning of 99. My big thing at Lightspan was the company was originally called Curriculum Television Corporation, and the idea was there's going to be this 500-channel universe. What we're going to do is build educational adventures that cover K through 8 math and language arts. We're going to run them on the set-top boxes. The schools, the cable companies are going to wire the schools up for free because they believe in this, and they're going to give away the set-top boxes to families so that the kids will be able to play this stuff at school and also play it at home. This is the future. Interactive television is the future, blah, blah, blah. By 1995, I'd been there for almost 2 years. I realized this was never going to happen.
Right.
It was a pipe dream. There was this thing called the Time Warner Orlando project that used $5,000 Silicon Graphics workstation set-top boxes and could barely get its way out of its own way, much less do real interactive programming. And so we're sitting here at the end of 1995. We've already spent $60 million. I mean, these guys at Lightspan, they wanted quality. So when they did in language arts, reading comprehension program, they turned it into a TV show about traveling back in time and being in jeopardy and having to solve these language arts, these comprehension problems about these texts, read something and get something out of it in order to get back with the time machine before bad things happen. And bad things would be like you're on a paddle wheeler on the Mississippi River that's doomed to blow up. You're at the War of 1812 in a battle that's going to go bad. You're at the San Francisco earthquake. Period pieces, actors, costumes. I mean, this was full go-for-it type stuff based on the idea that there'd be this 500-channel interactive video-on-demand universe happening in the middle of the 1990s. Isn't that amazing? Well, it wasn't going to happen. And everyone's basically staring at themselves going, what are we going to do? And I said, you know, I had a meeting in Japan once with a company called Sony, and they're working on something called the PlayStation. And I think the PlayStation is going to be able to do video, and I think the PlayStation is a pretty good machine. Now, we had done everything in Macromedia Director by then because that's what we wanted to do. We didn't want to build technology. But I basically cornered some people who had worked with me all the way back at Rising Star, a company called Real Time Associates, David Warhol. And they had a game engine that sort of worked on the Sony, also allowing you to use a PC to build Sony games. This was important because we needed a human wave effort to build over 100 CDs for the PlayStation. We had to build over 100 unique CD-ROMs for the PlayStation or to get this thing going. And so we basically had people on PCs writing this stuff without ever actually touching a Sony PlayStation, but it worked. And it wasn't fun, but it worked. And we got over 100 discs built for the PlayStation. We got the stuff deployed across schools around the country. We got Sony to go along with the idea that we would sell the schools PlayStations, and the schools would let the kids take them home. And we launched this in first Sony games rolled off the line in 97. And like I said, the 2000, February of 2000, we had an IPO where we had a market capitalization of $1 billion.
You had left by then, though, right?
I left the very beginning of 99 because I got roped into a .com that actually sounded really interesting and would have been really interesting. I was the CTO of a company for about a year called Save.com, which was doing online coupons. And this was a huge deal. Remember, this is .com thing is going full crazy. It's the idea that we had Save.com, coupons, online coupons. And I used people in the game industry who knew how to do things online that could work. And so we launched this, and we had 1 million people clipping coupons online. I'm not going to get into details here, but that company almost made me a very wealthy man. Both Lightspan and Save.com, one of those should have made me pretty darn well off. They didn't happen, partly because of the .com crash, and that's the story. And then let's segue to the 2000 decade because it gets interesting. So here I am. I've been away from Activision for 6 years, 7 years. I spent 5 years doing educational software, another market that is pretty much gone. Educational games were dead by early 2000. Just wasn't happening. What am I going to do? Well, I'm at an educational company consulting with an educational company, and I hear about what's going on in Japan with mobile phones with something called Docomo. NTT Telecom, Docomo, these really fancy, incredible color phones doing all sorts of apps and stuff, 1991, 2001, 2002. And I said, let's start doing stuff on those devices. So the first thing I did was I produced in 2000 a flashcard program for teachers where teachers could go online, input the flashcards, and kids could play them on their phones using what was called WAP, the browser for the phones in the United States. And I started working on mobile games for phones, you know, because that was where everyone I knew in the 80s who had been in the 90s who had been in games pretty much was segueing to. We all felt that this was going to be the next big thing. So in 2003, I worked for a company called Technic Digital Arts and produced this crazy title called Skill Strike, which was way too ambitious, four-player, multiplayer mobile game. But now comes the most unbelievable story of all time, and let me try to do this quickly. Someone at Lightspan had a license to do a game called Yo Mama. They wanted to do a video game with mothers fighting each other. I told them that was a stupid idea. They asked me to come up with something, and I came up with the idea, along with a woman named Sherry Kuno, who I still work with, of doing a Yo Mama insult card game. You'd have cards with Yo Mama insults on them. You'd trade them off between each other, and whoever had the best jokes would win. So we built the card game, and then we started working on the mobile game. We go to 2004 in San Diego, and guess who's sitting at the Topps booth? The Wayans brothers, and they have a game called The Dozens. It's the same game. I and Sherry had co-invented a game at the same time the Wayans were working on the same game. We never told them this. Instead, what we did is we negotiated with them and got the rights to do the mobile version of The Dozens. Now, in 2005, gotta get the decade right, mobile games were controlled by the carriers. You had a Verizon phone, you'd only be able to get games from Verizon. There'd be like 10 games, 20 games in the catalog, very controlled. So we came up with this wild idea. They were going to print out the cards. Every deck of cards would have in it a card that said, if you want to play this on your phone with your friends, just text this information to this number. Just text this number, and we'll get the game on your phone. And we did it. We got that to work. We had the game running as a text message game, as a WAP mobile game, and as a Java and Brew game. This thing was really ambitious. It had in-game chat. It had matchups from friends. You could invite a friend by putting their phone number into the game. It would send them a text message, and they'd be invited to play the game, actually install the game onto their phone and let them play you. Now, this is years before the App Store, and we pulled that off. We did the whole thing, and it was amazing, and people loved it. We had a booth at E3 in summer of 2005, the Wayans being in the booth. It was a big deal. Can you still hear me?
Yes, I can.
I thought my computer shut out. So what happened, what went wrong here was the card game was supposed to go into Walmart, But the weigh-ins were a little bit too risque, so Topps decided to sell the game at Blockbuster video stores, which was a bad move. And for reasons I don't want to get into, the people funding our company just ran out of steam. And amazingly, we're going around to Silicon Valley talking about how we're doing this game for the weigh-ins. People are going to be able to play each other on their phones. They use phones for communicating. They text message like mad. Don't you think it makes sense that they'd actually play a game against each other on the phone? Isn't that the future? And everyone would nod their head, and we did not get funding from Silicon Valley. But there's a reason for that. I'm not going to share the reason, but it's one of the things I would tell anyone starting a company that gets funded. Do due diligence on everyone involved in the company. Do background checks, because we had a problem that we didn't know we had a problem, and that problem prevented us from getting funded. Just leave it at that. If I go any further, I will be violating an agreement. So all of that happened. That was called Bonus Mobile. That was 2004, 2005. We had a slew of mobile games in development. We had this multiplayer mobile game technology. The card game bombed. We bombed. Sherry, who was the CTO, myself left. We formed a company called Mynumo. Mynumo started doing web-based games for the iPhone. Then we started doing apps for the iPhone. And for years, we actually supported ourselves by doing apps of every sort and description, cooking show apps, telecom apps, and our games, some amazing products. That company became PlayScreen. PlayScreen's game assets were purchased and became PlayScreen LLC in 2010. PlayScreen is best known for Bocce Ball, which is the best, or Bocce with Friends, which is the best-selling Bocce Ball game on the iPhone. Also, Billionaire Poker, a casino title in the UK called Casino Cash, a slew of visual trivia games, including Who's the Candidate and Stick Figure Movie Trivia. I came up with Stick Figure Movie Trivia, the idea. Sherry's team built it. I was basically initially the CEO, but eventually the chief creative officer. And that takes us to November, where the people who had funded PlayScreen needed someone to come into a enterprise software company and run mobile marketing for that company. So now I have two positions, one of my positions being the chief marketing officer for a company that does enterprise software, mostly virtualization of printers, called Tricerat. So I have two jobs, which is why I travel to the East Coast back and forth. And that pretty much takes us to today. That's where we're at.
It's interesting. You mentioned the venting someone. Take you back to the University of Penn days in the Moore School of Engineering, which was, of course, where the first working electronic computer
ENIAC
came from, the ENIAC.
ENIAC.
And the developers were John Morkley and J. Presper Eckert. But by the way, J. Presper Eckert also had an article in Digital Deli that I mentioned that I wrote for. They left after the development of that, and they formed the computer company, and they got a contract from the census to develop the computer, which they were going to build, and they were going to do all of the census or the IRS processing, and all of a sudden, the government pulled the contract. And they wound up then as vice presidents of Sperry, Remington Rand, and it came out years later that they pulled the contract because it was during the McCarthy years, and the background check showed that Morkley had belonged to the Communist Front organization in the late 30s when he was in college, and when he found out, he was bitter the rest of his life.
You know what's funny? I just watched last night the movie Trumbo. It's funny
You
bring this up. Have you seen the movie Trumbo yet? Do you know what it is?
I know about it. Yeah, Dalton Trumbo. Sure.
Right. It's a movie starring the guy who was in Breaking Bad, Bryan Cranston. He is brilliant.
Yep.
This is a brilliant movie. It was all about that sort of blacklist thing that happened in the 50s. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
You have to. It's such a good film.
Woody Allen had done a movie on that.
The Front.
The Front, right.
Zero Mostel.
Right.
Great movie. But this one's really good. This one's much better than The Front. It's so well acted. He's so good in that film.
They have
Helen Mirren as as a gossip columnist. Oh, just perfect.
Yeah, I have seen the the trailers on it that I am interested in. We now have, as you well know, the massive World of Warcraft user base and the fairly the recent acquisition of the Minecraft by Microsoft. Where do you see this whole industry going?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I was asked to talk about the Minecraft thing, and I felt that Minecraft was the educational software opportunity of the decade. I thought Microsoft did a really good job of buying it. Activision is very smart. You know, they got Blizzard early on, and they let Blizzard run independently, and Blizzard does really well. And Activision recently bought a big mobile game company. I think they bought – did Activision buy King or – let me see.
I don't know.
I think they did. Let me see. Yeah, they bought King Digital. They spent $5.9 billion on King. And people misinterpret this. They say, well, is it really worth that much to buy Candy Crush's creator for $5.9 billion? And my answer is, you bet you it is, because the thing that happened in mobile is that we went from selling games for a couple bucks to giving them away. Everything on mobile is free to play. Well, the thing about King is Candy Crush is one of the few games on mobile that has a good number of players per, you know, good percentage of the players paying for stuff. And Activision bought King for two reasons. One, they wanted it to basically have a great mobile game company. And two, they needed that expertise on how to get people spend money in a free game. Because like it or not, when we go to digital distribution on games and stop shipping shiny discs in boxes, everything will go to free-to-play. Because what happens is companies can come in and they can say, why don't we create something that's like Call of Duty but give it away and just have some things you buy for weapons and stuff, and that way people will try it rather than spending money on Call of Duty, just as a very gross example. But that's what's going to happen.
But there's millions of people spending money every month to play World of Warcraft.
Right, the subscription model is awesome, and you know, like you also see that in the world of tanks and world of warplanes and world of warships. Those games from the Russian developer, those things are doing really great. But those games are free to start. You don't have to spend anything to start in the game. You just spend money to get better weapons. And Activision knows that's going to happen, so they're preparing for it by buying King. They're buying people who are experts at getting people to fork over the cash in a game they think is free.
Yeah,
it's brilliant.
Interesting. On a somewhat related topic, in recent years we've had Jane McGonigal of the Institute of the Future deliver two extremely well-received TED Talks on gaming, and publish an equally or a mixed review book, A Reality Is Broken: Why Games Make Us Better Than How They Can Change the World. If you are familiar with her work, she postulates that we don't do too much gaming, but rather too little. So you're familiar with the work. Could you comment on it? Is she right?
Well, I'll tell you this much. Here's a radical idea. Education in our country is messed up. The one thing all the educational reform programs have done, whether it be No Child Left Behind or Common Core, the one characteristic they all share is complete and utter failure. And yet, children 12 years old, 10 years old, 8 years old will spend hours in Minecraft building worlds. Just, it seems to me, and I'm going to say this because I have nothing to lose, the philosophy in education is until morale improves, the beatings will continue. We have to get out of this idea here that what worked in 1895 is going to work in 2020. We should be creating, like, have you seen this game called Dragon Algebra? Dragon like a dragon?
I've heard about it, but no, I haven't seen it.
My God, this is a game that absolutely teaches hardcore algebra by the time you've gotten through the higher levels. Why isn't everything this way? I floated a plan in 2010 based on the philosophy that schools would drop books and go to tablets eventually. And what I wanted to do was build a whole curriculum like what we tried to do at Lightspan, but do it on tablets with touch and all that. Of course, if I did today, I would probably do it on Chromebooks because that seems to have won the battle on the educational front. But the point is still there. Create stuff that is, you know, they say in sales, pull is better than push. It's much better to have something that people absolutely want to get than to have to ram products down their throat through advertising hard. And in education, it's much better to get intrinsic motivation from students than it is to drill and kill them into learning the subject matter. We basically teach the test. We're falling off in terms of quality of education. We're falling off compared to the world. You can take any of the subjects you're talking about. You can take fractions. You can take algebra because Dragon Algebra proved that you can do this very well. And you can build these into interactive things that are just wonderful for the children. Why not do that? Why not make everything wonderful, self-paced and monitoring with the teachers basically acting as facilitators because they know what everyone is up to in the classroom. They can see what's going on from their console and from walking around. And they can basically have people, students learn at their own pace and their own learning styles, but be so motivated by this. And you know and I know that when kids go to school in the kindergarten and first grade, they're excited, they're interested. And by third or fourth grade, they're just defeated. A radical notion, but you know, why not make education more game-like? It can work. It should work. That was what Lightspan was based on. Lightspan had raised $120 million before the IPO. We were way, way too ahead of the game, but now it looks to me like the technology is everywhere. I mean, the one thing great about free-to-play, as much as I gripe about free-to-play games, is you go on an airplane and everyone on that plane, kids and adults, are playing things on their phones throughout the entire flight. Everyone spends a lot of time on these devices. You know,
and we should have seen that because I remember my son and a whole bunch of other people, whenever they went any place in school, they had to have their Game Boys with them because
I knew this was going to happen in the 80s. Anyone who was paying attention knew that once you had ubiquitous portable devices. That's why in the 2000 decade, I jumped on mobile phones because I knew this was the technology. And, you know, with virtual reality, it looks like virtual reality is going to end up being, in many cases, is a device that uses a mobile phone in some cases, where you take the Samsung phone, you strap it to the goggles, and there you go. So, you know, this can't – so education could really benefit from gamification if done right and done by people who know – you know, one thing that was awesome about Lightspan is Lightspan brought together crazy video game people like myself along with the best educators in the United States, people who had actually achieved success in education and educating children. And we did some amazing things. And now I look at Dragon Algebra. I use that as an example because it's just so good at what it does. It starts out with symbols, and you're trying to balance the symbols. And before you – you know, I'm talking about like objects like little dragons and creatures. But before you get, you know that continues, and eventually you're actually manipulating algebraic symbols and stuff. You're teaching algebra. Same thing can be done for geometry. Same thing can be done for writing, for reading. We could do so much, and we could basically turn education around and reduce the expense of education and so on. I mean, already you can see this starting to happen on the in the college level where people are starting to think that they should be doing more stuff online. It's just that, honestly, a lot of the online experiences are rather crappy, but there's no reason they can't be. If you marry the people who do build the most addictive, compelling game titles, things like Minecraft, things like Candy Crush, things like, Game of War, Gears of War, whatever, those skill levels applied to education can probably turn around education. I believe that. I really do.
So I remember looking at my son when he was in the early high school. He had cartoons published in Computer Shopper and other places that he had done the Macintosh. He was playing games on the Macintosh. He could sit for hours in front of the computer. Then I'd sit him down to study Spanish at the table. I have to get a drink. Can I go to the bathroom? I'm going to the bathroom. And it was just, there was no concentration to study Spanish after there had been this tremendous concentration on the games or on the cartooning. Yeah, it's
extreme. My son, one of my, yeah. one of my sons is an amazing project manager. He didn't go to college because he hated school. And he was one of the top 10 ranked world players in the world on a game called Total Annihilation, which is a real-time strategy game. So there's a real-time strategy game in the 90s called Total Annihilation, and my oldest son was one of the top players in the world. So he starts working as a tech at some company, soldering stuff and all that, and they realize, oh, my God, he knows logistics better than anyone. He learned it in the game. He learned logistics and management of resources, resource management in the game, and he's so good at it because of that. Yet he hated the classroom structure, couldn't stand it, because that's the way he is, you know, and a lot of children are like that. I'm aghast at how we, you know, in my case, I will tell you a little story about myself. I'm in third grade. I'd already been left back a year because everyone thought I was slow. And I'm in an art class, and they bring in blank 16-millimeter movie film and have the kids color it. And what the kids do is just put squiggles on it, and they run it through a projector, all nice and cute, right? I knew how movies worked. I had figured it out because I'd seen some Super 8 movies lying around the house. So I drew little pictures in every frame for an hour. And when they got to my section of the movie, I'm in third grade, mind you, they realized there was something really weird going on here, and they tested me and discovered I was a gifted child, and they put me into gifted child programs for the rest of my elementary school. That's the sort of thing that should be happening all the time, and it's not, because kids are basically going undiscovered. Whatever they're really smart at is going undiscovered because they're basically being put through the same cookie-cutter thing that everyone else is being put together through. But if you give them interactive things to interact with and create, as Minecraft or Dragon Algebra or many other things, I think they can really succeed. And I think we can actually turn education around.
The only problem with online stuff, and I've taught both. And
I'm advocating a classroom. I'm advocating a classroom with a teacher.
Oh, okay.
By the way, kids in the classroom with displays, with a teacher walking around and also looking at her device, saying, you know, hey, Susan is having a problem here with understanding, right angle triangles. She's stuck on this right now. Why don't you go over there and talk to her? You know, that's the sort of thing. And also collaboration, students helping each other.
That's the point I was going to make, because I've taught both at the college level, and I still think there are, at number one, at the in preparing an online course, you really have to do more, because since you can't see the people, what are they picking it up, you have to give them many more resources. What you lack is the ability to see you're not getting through to someone in the third row, second seat, you know, that's difficult. But what you're saying is do an interactive, but with the teacher, and that would be fine. So you're now in two different positions with two companies. What's next for you?
Well, the thing that's interesting about the IT world, even though it's not game-like, it's clear everyone wants to basically do what they would do for their work on a mobile device. They want to be able to untether themselves from where they are working and, you know, to be kind of blunt about it, hit the golf course, and if something goes wrong with one of the systems they're working for in a large company, they should be able to manage that right then and there. The people want to be freed up from, you know, having to be tethered to a desktop or even a laptop. They want to be able to do things on mobile devices. It's interesting. So that's interesting to me, and I'm pursuing that with the other company. On the game side, I'm paying attention to virtual reality. I finally got to play a VR game that I felt had promise, and that was Adrift, ADR number one FT. Adrift is an interesting game that basically creates a sort of world that existed in the movie Gravity. You're coming upon a space station that has been wrecked. You're floating around in zero gravity, so your controls are simply thrusters of your suit. And that works really well in VR because you're not walking, so you don't have that disbelief that you're really just sitting in a chair. You feel like you're drifting around in a drift, and you're controlling yourself through these thrusters and doing things. So Drift works. Very impressive virtual reality title, and I'd like to see more stuff happen there. So I'm paying attention to virtual reality. although I've been in the industry for so long, I remember dactyl terror from the 90s. I remember virtual reality 20 years ago. So I view virtual reality as a $0 billion business. It's nothing right now, but if it ever happens, it'll be huge. It'll be interesting to see how the console companies go with it.
Have you used the Google Cardboard at all?
Yeah, I have used Google Cardboard. And in fact, I have a friend who runs a game company called Handy Games in Germany. Chris Kozlowski runs a company called Handy Games in Germany, and I like Handy Games. They're innovative people, and they have some games for Google Cardboard. I tell people this: the reason why I like Cardboard or the thing where you attach the VR gear, where you attach a Samsung phone to a VR device, to glasses,
right,
is because it's less expensive for the users and for the developer. It's pretty low risk because if you're building a game in Unity, which we use for a lot of our titles, you know, we have some new titles coming out in Unity at PlayScreen. You build a title in Unity and you're building it for, let's say, a mobile phone. Saying you're going to have a title which is just a normal 3D game on the device, but it also functions in the VR mode, it isn't a big stretch. It reduces the risk. It gets things going. One of the lessons I've learned is when there's new technology coming out, really new technology, what succeeds initially is the familiar. You know, when James Cameron, and a curious note, in 2000 and 2001, Sherry and I briefly worked for James Cameron. That's how we got to meet each other. She's the technologist, chief technology officer of PlayScreen. When he did Avatar, which was the first big 3D movie hit, he used a theme that was very familiar to people, very familiar and something they could attach themselves to, because with a new technology, it's sometimes good to ground that in the familiar. So I expect one of the first things we'll see in VR are very familiar themes like first-person shooters and so on, because people will have a grounding in that and they'll understand that. So if you take a look at the new EA Star Wars game, you could see that as a VR game very easily. That would work really. Star Wars Battlefront, whatever it's called, you know, that's going to work very easily.
So we've touched a lot of bases tonight. What else might you like the audience to know about William Vogt?
Well, I will tell you this much. One of the things that happened to me early in my career was it was Philips, the CDI people, gave me a Keyman insurance policy in 1986. It scared the crap out of me, and I got onto a big kick with cycling, which I had done in college, and taking care of myself. So I'm actually very happy that I've gotten to this point and, you know, ride my bike almost every day and, you know, travel and do interesting things, because I decided early on that that was important. And so I'm very fortuitous and lucky to have had that happen in my career, because it led to many good things in my life. And I will say, as difficult as games are now, and they are, because you have everyone and their mama building games for every device, It's extremely cool to see people come out of nowhere with unique and wonderful ideas and succeed. So there's always that possibility. It's very nice.
Thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure. So.
All right. Well, thank you. I look forward to hearing more about this. I got to get off the phone now, so I'll say goodbye.
Okay. And I will have the recording to you sometime this evening.
Well, thank you so much.
A bit of commercial information. My column now appears biweekly in Westchester Guardian, along with regular columns by Congressperson and co-chair of the 9/11 Commission, Lee Hamilton, and John Simon. Westchester Guardian is available in print format and online at www.westchesterguardian.com. My books are available at Amazon, and I blog at johnmack13.johnmackrants. com. And John McRantz is JohnMacRents. Send in comments about this show or questions to me at johnmack13@gmail.com. And in the words of Mets radio announcer Howie Rose, after the Mets win, put it in a book. Join us next week for author and dancer Sari Wilson. Until then, as he used to say in the old neighborhood, see ya. Steady, silver, steady.
Good night, everyone. Bye.
Good night, everyone.